This is Talking Asset Management with KPMG. And today's episode is about state unitary issues and credit.
Hello, and thank you for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. I'm Dr. Tomasovic from KPMG State and Local Tax Practice. In credit, assault topics include economic nexus and market-based sourcing. These tend to be the starting point for any underwriting or structuring. However, we should add to the list the implications of operating a unitary business. After all, a unitary business has the potential to affect nexus, apportionment, and reporting. And with that, today we're going to talk about state unitary issues and credit. Joining me today to discuss are my colleagues, Scott Salmon and Diliana Annable. Scott, Diliana, welcome.
Thank you, Datis.
Scott, you know, maybe to kick things off, what is the unitary business principle?
Sure. The unitary business principle is a concept that has been developed by case law in interpreting the right of states to tax income under the U.S. Constitution that defines kind of the outer limits of the income that can be sourced to a state using formulary apportionment, for example, using the sales factor. Another way to think of this is that when one company uses in part the apportionment factors of another company in computing its own state tax base, both of those companies have to be engaged in what we call a unitary business relationship. Now, that's most often seen in the context of what entities, generally corporations, would be included in a state's unitary combined reporting regime, which combines the income and apportionment factors of such entities in determining the state taxable income of the group. The unitary business principle is also important in the context of partnerships, in that apportionment factors of a partnership only should be able to flow through to a partner that is part of the same unitary business group, a same unitary business group as the partnership. In other words, you know, when the partner is going to use the apportionment factors of the partnership to help determine the partner's state tax base, they need to be in a unitary business relationship.
So Scott, this principle, it's been around for quite some time, like a century. Do we continue to see developments in this area, or are we just applying this historical principle to new structures and ways of doing business?
Well, as you noted, Datis, I mean, the unitary business principle has been around for quite some time, did evolve over time, but has pretty set principles, some of which are somewhat objective, some of which are subjective, which we'll talk about. But really, I think the challenge is applying those concepts to new structures and new ways of that the economy functions in this modern day. So, for example, you know, some of the characteristics of a unitary business. The unitary business principle is defined first and foremost by a control relationship amongst the parties. In other words, at least one party has direct or indirect control over the other parties, but also actually exercises that control. In the context of a corporation, the ability to control usually is defined by having, a party having more than ownership of more than 50% of the voting stock of the other company. In the context of a partnership or a limited liability company, that ability to control might be represented by the party that is the largest general partner of a partnership or the party that is the managing member of a limited liability company. Now, secondly, the exercise of that control, and again, exercise is a purposeful word to be distinguished from the just having the mere ability control, but the actual exercise of that control should result in some synergies and flow of value amongst the parties that at least in theory is difficult to measure through separate accounting. And when I say separate accounting, kind of think of transfer pricing. This part of the unitary business test is obviously much more subjective as opposed to, you know, determining the ability to control. And some of the tests that are developed over the years that look for characteristics of this subjective nature of the unitary business principle will use words and phrases such as horizontal integration, having economies of scale, having a centralized executive force, having a general system of operations, trademarks, and trade names, having functional integration, and also having centralized support functions such as accounting, legal, HR, and purchasing. However, the underlying theme of all those potential characteristics and tests is identifying a flow of value that results as a consequence of the unitary relationship. That type of analysis holds a lot of challenges. As I mentioned, it's a very subjective has a very subjective nature to it. You know, some of the challenges that you often see is determining whether there's a unitary relationship between a holding company and subsidiaries that it owns. Another potential difficult area would be determining unitary business relationship amongst brother-sister entities that may not have a lot of integration between themselves, but are all integrated with a common parent company, and whether that creates a larger unitary business group.
So Scott, you know, with all that said, you kind of talked kind of this overarching principle of unitary business defines kind of these limitations of what a state can impose. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, as I mentioned, the unitary business principle kind of defines the outer bounds, you know, this concept of, you know, the income that can be sourced by formulary apportionment in looking to other members of this larger unitary business group. You know, the logical extreme of that would be worldwide combined reporting. Now, not very few states have a requirement of worldwide combined reporting, and all the states that do have such a requirement also allow for an election to use a water's edge style of reporting, which I think, you know, Deliana is going to talk about a little bit. But then there's also other states that, you know, their default method of combined reporting is simply a water's edge method, rather. And there are certain states that are, you know, defined by only requiring the particular company that has nexus to file in the state without any combined reporting requirement. And so most states stay well within the bounds of the unitary relationship, but you know, those states that do require unitary businesses to file combined, you know, it is necessary to determine what entities have that unitary relationship.
So something to consider then, it sounds like with these potential elections out there is being, you know, having some type of understanding of the lay of the land, what is the default methodology, and, you know, whether or not we need to timely file any elections to perhaps, you know, limit the taxing ability of the state.
It's fair to say.
So Deliana, you know, we just talked conceptually background of the unitary business principle. You work a lot in credit. Can you give us an example, you know, what we're seeing, you know, how this is applied within the credit context?
Sure, Datus. As Scott mentioned, some of the prerequisites to a unitary relationship include common control and flow of value. Now, how does that apply in the private equity firm context and to credit funds specifically? In the PE firm context, we often have portfolio companies that may operate independently, are not under centralized management, and don't exhibit functional integration. So even though they may be commonly controlled and there is flow of value between them, the other criteria that Scott talked about, including unity of use and unity of operation, may not be met. How credit funds are slightly different than PE firms in general is that we often see that credit funds are in the same line of business, which is lending. They often use the same deal team to originate or purchase loans. They share know-how, technology, operate under the same investment parameters and risk management controls. So all of these facts taken together collectively could make them part of a unitary business.
So Deliana, what are some of the implications then of being part of a unitary business?
As Scott mentioned, the unitary business principle was designed in order for states to reach extraterritorial value. So you may have one member with nexus that pulls in non-nexus members into a combined group. And what's interesting is that for state purposes, a state applies the rules to the group as a whole. And when this is done, you may have entities that for federal purposes do not have a U.S. trade or business under the code or due to the operation of a treaty. But when they're included in a combined group, the group as a whole may be engaged in a trade or business. And we've had instances in California with combined reporting where we had an entity that purchased and originated few loans, but this did not raise to the level of a U.S. trade or business. There was no ECI for federal purposes. However, for California purposes, the group was engaged in a trade or business, causing this entity, which only had FDAP income, to be included and subject to tax on a worldwide basis. And the Water's Edge election that is available in California didn't help them because they exceeded the 20% factor present threshold, which made the base upon which California computes tax to be worldwide income as opposed to, you know, just federal ECI, which is the norm in most states. I covered some of the detrimental consequences, but there are some positive consequences of unitary reporting in some states as well, because you could have apportionment dilution when foreign members are added to the group. They can help dilute the denominator of the apportionment formula. And you can have situations where you can utilize certain attributes, including state NOLs and credits on a combined group basis, which could not otherwise be utilized on a standalone basis.
So Diliana, it sounds like really just depending on the fact pattern, the jurisdictions at issue, there could be some potential opportunities or pitfalls or traps for the unwary. And it's really having an understanding of the jurisdictions and perhaps even modeling out the implications to see, is it a benefit or a detriment? And if there are any timely needed considerations, such as elections, to be sure that we're accounting for all that as part of any perhaps diligence, underwriting, or structuring.
Yeah, that is correct, Dennis. It depends on the rules in each jurisdiction. It also depends on the fund's structure. For example, we see structures that involve mortgage REITs. And when those REITs are unitary with their owners and combined, we can have a situation where the REIT loses the federal DPD, which is not available for state purposes when the REIT is combined with its owner. So this analysis is, number one, very fact specific, and number two, it could be very subjective, and there is no one criteria that would make a group unitary or not. It's the combination of criteria and the preponderance of facts that does that.
Wonderful. So as it goes in state and local tax, it all depends. So I think with that, thank you all for listening. We want to hear from you. If you have any questions about this topic or anything else, please reach out to me, Scott, Diliana, or any of your KPMG contacts. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series and visit read.kpmg.us/talking-asset-management for more information.